Okay. Nobody heard. Oh, there we go. As always, I'd like to begin this evening by recognizing our sponsors, Adele and Hai Itzquit, sponsoring this evening in memory of Adele's mother, Beatrice Perlich, Batya Rivka Bat Tzvi Aleha Shalom. And it's Batya, not Bitya, right?
Right, gotcha.
Right. Now, yeah, saw a couple of people engaged in a debate, not about your mother, but about the daughter of Pharaoh. We will call her Batya, but she actually, the name is vowelized in Divrei HaYamim as Bitya, but Chazal call her Batya as the daughter of God, even though she's called Bithya. I don't know, in the Ten Commandments, how is she referred to? I think she's called Bithya. Who knows what Cecil B. DeMille was reading. But nonetheless, I want to thank you for your sponsorship. And wish your mother's neshama an aliyah, and our learning will be in her memory this evening. So I thank you, and may her memory be a blessing. So we turn this evening to Parashat Va'era. Last week, in many ways, was stage setting. The book of Exodus has begun. The Jews are slaves. We had some noteworthy moments along the way. The heroism of the midwives who are the first to stand up against Pharaoh's edicts and very consciously object to the moral bankruptcy that is let loose on the populace. But in many ways, it's setting the stage. We get Moshe's origin story. He is born, is we're told he looks good as he's born, and there will hold debate about what that meant. He makes his way across the Midbar and escaping from threats against his life, and he finds his way back to Egypt eventually after a visitation from God and an insistence that he goes back to save the people. And this week we begin in earnest with a confrontation between God and Egypt. And it actually begins with a critique of Moshe. Ironically enough, that is the opening sentence and sentiment of the parasha. So last week it finished with a sense of despair on the part of the Jews, not because they were still enmeshed in slavery, but because the attempt at redemption had failed. Moshe had spoken to Paro, and Paro's response was, "Oh, you want me to set them free? Well, guess what? Now they can go make bricks without straw. See how you like that?" And kicks them out, which doesn't go down well with the people. Who are now under more strain and more mental strain because they had hope that was then taken away. And in the wake of that, Moshe asks one of the more troubling questions any prophet turns to God. We've noted in the past that Avraham's questioning of God in the lead up to the destruction of Sodom is radical and astonishing in that he says, "Is it possible, Hashofet Kol Haaretz Lo Ya'aseh Mishpat, that the judge of all the earth will commit injustice?" But there, at least, it is a question. Whereas Moshe finishes last week not by saying, "Is it possible that you're doing something unjust?" but taking for granted that God has done something evil. Lama hareota lama zeh? Why do you do evil to this people? Which is a for want of a better term, a rash, aggressive, hostile, belligerent indictment of providence, saying, "Why have you done this evil? Not please explain this to me, but how could you do this evil?" And the parsha opens this week, Parsha Va'era, with a straightforward sentiment that ends that conversation, it seems. And I think I've noted this in a past year, that it is the most mundane of sentences, the most ordinary of verses that actually contains a profound insight about patience, sympathy, and sensitivity. And it is the second verse of the parsha, Vayedaber Elokim al Moshe, and God said to Moses, Vayomer Elav, and he said to him, Ani Hashem, I am God. And on the face, it looks like God is simply turning to Moshe and saying, quit your questioning. Ani Hashem, I'm God. Enough with your fussing, enough with your complaining, enough with your supposed indictments. You know, I'm God. Stop fussing. But actually, on closer inspection, the sages detect, as they always do, excess. And I have to say, in preparing for this evening, I'm always surprised by things I find in the parasha that I'm not aware of, having heard it every year since I've been paying attention. And each year thinking, what am I going to find? And I found something that surprised me very much, we'll get to as we summarize the parasha. But this opening sentence with a little bit of pressure unveils a new dimension. Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe, and God said to Moses, Vayomer lav, and he said to him, I am God. And here the excess is multiple. It says, and God said to Moses, and he said to him. So already we've got two he said. We don't need two he said. Vayomer Hashem is at the end. Vayidaber Elokim is at the front. So who's speaking? Is this Elokim speaking or is this Hashem speaking? And of course, the final redundancy is it says, and God said to Moses, and he said to him. So we've got him saying twice. We've got the name of who's speaking, changing from Elohim to Hashem, meaning Yud Kei Vav Kei. And then we've got, and he spoke to Moses, and he spoke to him. So it seems a little messy, right? If one is looking at a verse through a prism of concision and precision. And it's read in different ways. Rashi straightforwardly reads this as we're trying to stress the point that God is inscrutable, mysterious, unknowable, all-powerful. And Moshe, as we noted last Shabbat, Moshe doesn't have, or last Thursday night as well, Moshe doesn't know that much about God. He wasn't brought up, suffused with discussions of the Torah or discussions of patriarchal or matriarchal history. He's brought up in the palace in Egypt with Egyptian law and Egyptian myth. He then makes his way out. And before he can have a single conversation with the Jews about their culture, he is accused by them of being tyrannical. So you're going to kill us, but you killed it. And he runs off. So he now spends time in Midian. So his exposure is to Egyptian myth, Midian law, L-O-R-E, and he has a visitation. God sees him in a fire, but he says, what's your name? How am I to introduce you? And he knows, we get intimations that Moshe is familiar with aspects of Jewish history. God introduces himself at the fire saying, I am the God of your father, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he must have some sense of Jewish culture, legacy, and being. But he's still trying to figure out, what does it mean to be a prophet? How does it mean to operate in this way? And it could well be that in Pharaoh's palace, if something wasn't quite to Pharaoh's liking, he accused the gods. And, you know, I'm a god. I got into a fight with the gods. I don't know if any of you have seen Gods of Egypt. That was a two-part movie series, I think. I did not see it. I saw a clip of it or a trailer of it. But I know some ancient Egyptologists did see it and were not that impressed. But it's very much like the Greek pantheon, where human beings can engage with the gods in combat, likely to lose. But the gods are not these inscrutable, wise beings. They're flawed and fallible, just immeasurably more powerful. So it could be that as Shemot begins, this is another education of Moshe as the prophet, as to, you don't get into combat with me, you don't ask me questions, you don't accuse me of things, you don't indict me, certainly not in front of the people. Ani Hashem, I am Yud Kei Vav Kei, I am the creator of all being, and you will do my bidding in silence. Which is a pretty severe way to begin the parasha, but that's precisely how Rashi reads it. And that's why it begins Vayidaber, which is Dibur, is seen as a harsh form of utterance as opposed to Amira. It begins Vayidaber, and it begins Vayidaber Elokim. Even though he says, say again. Oh, even though he says, Ani Hashem, I'm Yud Kei Vav Kei, that's his introduction. but the way the verse introduces God is Elohim. This is a severe, harsh assault on the prophet. That's how Rashi reads this. The Kli Akar slows us down. And he says that actually this sentence is not repetitive and redundant and an overwhelming severity assaulting Moshe. There are two sentiments here. The first half of the sentence and the second. And the first half is Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe. And Elohim, Daber, spoke harshly al Moshe to Moses. That's the first half of the verse. And then we ought to pause and breathe. And then the next half is Vayomer Elav, and he said to him, Ani Hashem, I am Yudke Vavke. And the Kli Akar suggested in the middle of this verse, God has a change of heart, so to speak, or God models for us a change of heart. And I've used this example in the past as well, but it happened to come up this evening, so I'll use it again, which is, in my experience as a parent, I'm sure many others had or have the same experience, but I'm sure it's true equally as a spouse or a sibling or a friend or a peer or a neighbor or a fellow citizen. There are instinctive moments of impatience that we all experience in relation to people who we expect know better. And I have that experience with my children. There was a point this evening where one of my children wasn't paying attention and I got a little, I don't know if testy is the right word, and I got a little heated in my, let's say I did a dibur instead of an amira. And, you know, at some point, you know, I say, you know, you're not a baby anymore. You're 5 years old. You know, you should know better than this. But the truth is, even a five-year-old is kind of a baby. So I should kind of, I had a moment to breathe and relax. And the Kli Akar suggests that this is what God is modeling for us, that Moshe objects to God at the end of last week. How could you do this evil? And God instinctively, Lahavdel, models for us, Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe. And God responded to Moses, said, "You're Moses, shush, don't you accuse me of anything. I'm God. And, you know, you're Moses. You are going to be the liberator, the lawgiver. You're going to split the sea. You're going to win wars against Amalek. You're going to deliver this people through the wilderness. You are the prophet of God. You can't speak that way." But then he takes a breath and Vayomer, and suddenly the sentiment softens. And God's response to Moshe is no longer speaking to the Moshe of expectation, El Moshe, but Elav, to who he is in that moment right now. So from Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe, where God instinctively responds to Moses, who he could be, he turns Vayomer softly, a love to him as he is right now. He is not yet that person at the end of his prophetic career. And it's Ani Hashem. He says, "I am a God of compassion." He says, it may look like this is heartless. The fact that Pharaoh objected to my first overture and he gave the people more work may look callous and unsympathetic and uncompassionate on my part. But know, Ani Hashem, that I am a compassionate God. And there is compassion inbuilt in this long road to freedom. So that's a Kli Akar, which I can't help but share because it is such a powerful sentiment, but also it's such a powerful exegetical experience to see an apparently mundane verse, right? Elohim el Moshe v'yom elav Ani Hashem, and render that into two segments that represent a model in which we are invited to pause, reflect, and be calm when it comes to expectations of other people. And we'll see that reflected throughout the parasha as well. So that's just the second verse. So we have Rishon, and in Rishon, we have the moment I referenced last week when Moshe gives the overview to the people, having been told by God to not question anymore and to go and give the people a sense of what's going to happen. He goes and he lays out the plan where we've got the four phrases of redemption, where God says, "I will redeem you, I will free you, I will lead you, and I'll bring you to the land." But the people don't hear Moshe. We told they didn't listen. Lo shamu elav, they didn't hear him for two reasons. Mikotzer ruach u'mavadah kasha, from shortness of spirit, and from hard work. We noted last week the unique reading of Gersonides, the Ralbag, that says that the kitzirat ruach, the shortness of spirit, was actually a description of Moshe here. That Moshe didn't have the rhetorical interest or talent to express himself clearly to the people, and that's why they didn't understand it. But that was a unique reading. We'll kind of leave that to the side, because there is still a whole range of readings as to what the people were suffering from, that they couldn't hear what Moshe had to say. Kotzer ruach, kitziat ruach, is a shortness of the spirit. And it's been read in any number of ways. The first way Rashi reads it is straightforwardly, they were short of breath. Kotzer ruach, they just couldn't catch their breath, so they couldn't really focus. It's impossible to think straight when you're exhausted and you're worn out. And we'll come back to that. And if I don't, remind me to come back to that, because the Kli Yakar has something additional to add. And I'll note as a side point, the Kli Yakar is not really an independent commentator. He is a super commentator on Rashi, who goes in at great length to describe what one modern work calls what's bothering Rashi. The Kli Yakar does that at great length often. So we'll come back to what the Kli Yakar has to say about them being short of breath and they couldn't understand. But for Rav Hirsch, they couldn't hear Moshe because choser savlanut, they were lacking in what savlanut, anyone familiar with the?
Patience.
Excellent, patience. They were lacking in patience, meaning Moshe was describing, and I think I have to imagine we're all feeling this to some degree now, if we haven't been feeling it for 18 months already, which is to hear. I think I saw a headline that Fauci, Dr. Fauci was quoted this morning as predicting that the Omicron peak would come at the end of January, and somebody else predicting that this would be the last major wave, which of course somebody predicted with the Delta. And, you know, we're all kind of, we're out of patience. And to hear, you know, the long-term four-month plan, somebody was interviewed, I saw somebody who works in, I think, the Harvard Business School, who has done a reasonably effective job of predicting how things are going to unfold, which is only effective until it's not. Everybody predicts well until they don't. But he essentially suggested there are going to be three phases to getting through this pandemic, like any other major crisis. There's the first phase, which is we're still trying to deal with the kind of the shock to the system. And he says, we're still in that. And then we're going to have 2 years of recovery, economically, emotionally from this. And then we're going to have kind of the bounce back. And that's not going to start till 2024, when there's going to be a new wave of economic prosperity, and we're going to kind of be kind of propelled out of this. That was his claim. He's written a book, so obviously wants them to buy his book. But, you know, that gives hope for about a minute, thinking, oh, there's a way out. There is a, you know, a plan. But then, of course, you remember he's not a prophet, so it's not a guarantee. And even if it was a guarantee, 2024 is a long way away to start thinking about, oh, things are going to be great again. That's, you know, 2.5, 3 years away. And Moshe telling the people, oh, don't worry. There is a long-term plan to get out of here. We're going to, there are going to be some plagues. I'm going to go back and forth with Pharaoh. We're going to make our way out. We're going to walk through the desert. And the people just lo shamu, they weren't listening. Mikotzer ruach. They're like, don't come at us with these long-term plans, with these PowerPoint presentations. We need to get out like yesterday. You need to get on with it right now. And Moshe learns in this moment the importance of communication. And again, a sense of how they feel. It is, I don't know if it's an irony or if it's a necessity, that the people who free, the person who leads the Jews to freedom is someone who was never enslaved. It is, this is, Lahavdil peripherally, this is why Freud has a whole strange reading in his final work called Moses and Monotheism, I think is what it's called, his final book that was published when he was living in London, where he suggests, with absolutely no evidence at all, but basically to turn the story into a mythic version of something to do with the subconscious, suggests that Moses was not Jewish. He was an Egyptian. He was a complete outsider. And then he goes on some deep end where he suggests that the Jews got together and killed Moses and then regretted it forever, which is why we're all so neurotic. So this was his psychoanalytic explanation of why Jews are plagued by neurosis, because we're actually plagued by guilt for having killed our liberator. And that's why we keep commas and keep the Mosaic law to the T, because we're trying to redeem ourselves for some horrific original sin. So that's his version of Jewish guilt. We've got other versions, which is we make each other feel guilty. That's what we do. But Freud is picking up on a detail that is odd. If we think about the freedom fighters through Western history, if we think about modern American history, those who fought in civil rights for voting rights and those who fought to end discrimination, it tends to be people who have suffered that discrimination lead the fight to stop it. In South Africa, it was some Nelson Mandela. Here, you've got Martin Luther King Jr. There are people who are like bandy together with those who are suffering and say, let me lead us out of this. And Moshe was not enslaved. Moshe grew up in the palace. He fled under the threat of death. He made his way back and said, I'm here to free you. And one could imagine the people feeling like, who are you? Who are you to free us? You've never experienced. This is to some degree what Rav Hirsch is suggesting, the massive gap mentally between Moshe and the people, where Moshe is quite happy to sit down and say, okay, here's the plan. And the people are like, plan? You're coming at us with a plan? We need to get out. We're exhausted. And we don't have patience for this. And that's not to say Moshe was the wrong choice. It could quite well be that in this context, Moshe is precisely the right choice. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in Shabbat morning. But he is being prepared for leading people that he does not share in common an experience with. To some degree, when I spoke about civil rights in the United States, that was fundamentally different to the age of actual slavery. Because those who wanted to end the slave trade, it tends to be, there are of course occasional figures, and I'm not an expert on this era in history, and if somebody knows more, feel free to chime in. Those who fought to end slavery largely were not African Americans, because African Americans were enslaved. If I think about who led the charge to end the slave trade in the UK, it was William Wilberforce. We think about, you know, Abraham Lincoln in the United States. And I'm sure there were African-Americans who participated in that cause. And of course, in the Civil War, there were African-Americans who fought in the Civil War. But largely speaking, it was people who had the privilege of power who fought to shift the levers of power. And Moshe is a choice here, because the people who don't have patience, not because they're impatient people, but because they have been plagued with pain since they were born, are perhaps not the perfect people to lead a campaign to free a nation. And Moshe comes at it with that experience and capacity, but here he recognizes that there is something, there is a cost there, which he needs to go the extra mile to identify with those he's trying to free, which is not easy. That's the way Rav Hirsch reads, that they couldn't hear him. Makotza Ruach wasn't just that they were breathless, but they were impatient. And Moshe learns that he's going to have to not only convince Pharaoh to free them, but convince the people to trust him. And that's going to be a lifelong mission to get them to trust him. And there's only one time where we know they fully trusted him, because the text tells us that they fully trusted him. And the fact that the text tells us they trusted him is an indication that that was not compelling the rest of the time. What is the one moment we know that people trusted Moshe?
Yaminu b'Hashem Moshe Abdo.
There we go. Exactly. As the sea is split, and this is the overwhelming moment where relief comes and the people walk through a split ocean. V'yaminu b'Hashem Moshe Abdo. And they had faith in God and in Moses, his servant. And that was kind of the singular moment of clarity where people who the majority, and by majority, I mean everyone bar two, doesn't make it to the promised land. They're not conditioned to be able to make their way to a place of trust. They're so traumatized. And Moshe learns that right off the bat here. When he comes, says, God told me this is the plan, and they can't hear it. That's the way Rav Hirsch reads it. The Netziv has a very different reading, where Mikotza Ruach, he actually says shortness of spirit. It doesn't mean anything temperamental, whether it's talking about the physiological temperament of being breathless or the emotional temperament of being impatient, but it speaks to their theological commitment. They had a short ruach, they had a short theological imagination. And actually, it wasn't that they didn't have the patience for the plan. They didn't have the will to go free. For the Netziv, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people didn't want to go. They weren't, we wouldn't say they were happy, but they had become content with their state. And they've come to accept that the Egyptian culture was comfortable. And I'm not about to go on a rant about American culture and our comforts, because obviously that's not comparable or parallel. But I didn't want you to think that's where I was going. But the Netziv here says that they settled in Egypt. And yes, they were the bottom of the food chain. But it was a chain they recognized, where there was Ra at the top and Amun Ra at the side and a panoply and a pantheon. And there was a system. Next semester, I'm teaching a course at YU that I've not taught for a couple of years. And when I taught it last time, I didn't really know what I was doing. So I still don't really know what I'm doing, which will be Paradise Lost. And the kind of, I'm doing some investigations into the history that precedes John Milton in the 1600s. And you'd think I'm English, I should know all about English history, but then you'd have to assume I paid attention in school, which would be a fatal mistake to assume that. And the underpinnings of Western European mental structures was something that Arthur Lovejoy in the 1900s in a lecture series that he gave called The Great Chain of Being. That was the presumption, which is actually something that Marx pushed back on about religion writ large. But the question that Marx posed that I mentioned in a Yoltsach Shift Rabbi Sachs, that why, if there are billions of people being oppressed and three people doing the oppressing, don't the billions of people get up and rebel? It's just inexplicable that over the course of history, people were being exploited, they were being marginalized, they were being harassed. And we're not talking about a small group of impoverished people. We're talking about the overwhelming majority of human beings. Even those who were in the monarch's employ were being shouted at, looked down upon, oppressed, scorned, mocked. Why do people tolerate this? And it was so ingrained in the mentality, this notion, there's something called the great chain of being, that God has set up the cosmos in a way where there is a hierarchy and there is a divine right of kings and occasionally queens who sit at the top. And then there are the aristocrats, the noblemen, the lords, the dukes. Then there are some of the financiers, the commercial. Then you've got the plebeians or the commoners. And then you've got the animals and then you've got the plants and the rocks, and we're all part of a grand cosmos. And actually, to upset the great chain of being is more problematic emotionally than just to deal with the fact that I'm towards the bottom of the chain, which is why so many in historians' estimation were willing to put up with the system and couldn't imagine objecting to it. And it took many, many centuries. And Rabbi Jonathan Sachs would argue a Judaic reading of biblical tradition to recognize that we are not meant to put up with the way things are. And in many ways, the whole story of the Exodus is to make that point, that the status quo doesn't have to be defended as a religious truth. But here, the people, Mikotzer Ruach, from a impoverished spiritual imagination, didn't want to hear Moshe's plan. They didn't want to go free. What did they want? They wanted a little bit of an easier life. They didn't want to have to make bricks without straw. They wanted to have weekends off. They were happy to have kind of shifts around the edges. But hold on a minute, Moshe. You're talking about leaving? You're talking about giving up the place that I've lived in my whole life and coming to a new place and wandering away and not being part of this hierarchy that gives me a sense of purpose and place in the cosmos? And the Netziv, and this is a theme that he runs throughout the Exodus story, and the Netziv actually has a commentary on the Haggadah, which is unflinching in his assumption that the Jews didn't want to leave Egypt. And not just like three or four of them, but the overwhelming majority didn't want to leave. And this comes to a midrash that speaks about a plague next week in the plague of darkness, where traditionally it's understood that a huge proportion of the Jewish population was killed in the plague of darkness. And some justify the plague on that basis, saying, what is darkness doing here? It was so that God could weed out the faithless Jews before he set them free, which has always troubled commentators to some degree, that 80% of the Jewish population was wiped out, not by the Egyptians, but by God. And the Netziv is on board with that, not in a state of joy, but as an observation, the Jews didn't want to leave. And that's what Kotzei Ruach means for the Netziv. So we've got Rashi's version that they were out of breath. We've got the Rav Hirsch's view that they were impatient, that they wanted to get out right now. And the Netziv's version, and it's just fascinating contrast of Hirsch and the Netziv, who are living in exactly the same time, but in radically different places. Well, Rav Hirsch is living in enlightened Prussia, in Frankfurt, moving around to Berlin and elsewhere. And he's kind of in the world of revolution, where the French Revolution has already taken place. Europe is in turmoil as kings are being overthrown. And Rav Hirsch says the Jews, they just want to get out of there. They were ready for revolution. And the Netziv, who was living on the eastern edge of Europe, Russian territory, where things were politically tended, at least in his time, to be a little more stable, where monarchs were a little more content that they had their place on the throne, with standing armies and a sense of the Soviet legacy, he thinks people are comfortable. He has the same Marxist critique of the Jews of Egypt. They didn't want to leave. And that's in its even of Hirsch. But I said we would come back to there is another version that Kotzei Ruach meant they were hopeless. They didn't have any hope. They thought we could not leave. Rabbeinu Bachya, some of the medieval commentators have this view, that they were Kotzei Ruach. Doesn't mean that they couldn't breathe, but it meant that they had no oxygen, they had no fuel left. They had been worn down to the point where they're like, Moshe, don't tease us with ideas of hope. We know we're not going out. You know, do you know how many people over the last 210 years have said, let's go free, let's stand up? We imagine that no one ever objected, but the Rabbeinu Bach and others invite us to consider that perhaps every couple of decades there was somebody who got up and said, let's fight and let's go free, and it never worked, never happened, never went anywhere. And Moshe's just the latest in the line of people who have come to suggest we should object, and they're out of hope at this point. What I said I would come back to is the Kli HaKara says they couldn't hear because they were out of breath, and the Kli HaKara adds that actually this is what leads Moshe to have a misconception about the people, because Rashi seems like a very power of reading. They were out of breath, so they couldn't hear it. Okay, that's an odd factual observation, but that doesn't tell us anything about the state of the people or the state of Moshe. It just says Moshe tried to give over the plan, and it wasn't received because they were kind of catching their breath. And what the Kli HaKara suggests is it actually led to a deep misunderstanding that seeped its way into the relationship between Moshe and the people for the rest of their time together, which was Moshe thought the people were any one of those things we've just noted from the Netziv through Rav Hirsch, through Rabbeinu Bachya, which is he thought, oh, they don't want to hear this, they're impatient. Oh, they don't want to hear this, they don't want to leave. Or they don't want to hear this, they've got no fuel left, they're a hopeless bunch of people who I'm going to have to carry out of here on my back. He thought all those things. And what Kli HaKara suggests is actually none of that is true. They were more than willing to hear what Moshe had to say, but they couldn't physically express themselves because they couldn't catch their breath. They were literally exhausted. You know, Moshe turns up, it's, you know, 5:30 p.m. on a Monday. They've just finished, you know, their third shift of the day. And Moshe's like, okay, here's the plan. And everyone's like, and Moshe says, okay, so what do you think, guys? And there's just like the tumbleweed rolls by. No one responds. And Moshe thinks, oh my gosh, these people are hopeless. They don't want to leave. They're impatient. I don't know what to do with these people. But it turns out, actually, they were more than willing to listen. They were just physically catching their breath. And actually, it turns out the impatient figure in this scene for the Kli HaKara is Moshe. who didn't probe a little further and say, okay, I understand no one responded. Maybe that's because, you know, you're actually physically tired. Can I try that again? Is anybody on board? And it was Moshe's impatience or lack of self-confidence that led him to think instantaneously, like he said last week when he was sent on the mission, they're not going to believe me. He thinks that they don't believe me. And he kind of panics instantly instead of saying, hold on a minute, maybe there's another explanation. So the Kli Yakar invites us to see in that moment and recognize that if we don't get the response we're expecting, we can sometimes be the impatient party if we don't take a moment to think about what are the possible explanations for why I'm not being well received. And sometimes out of a sense of lack of confidence, we can presume the worst in other people, that, oh, they're not listening to me because, oh, they don't have the patience for it. And actually, if we just take a moment and say, everything okay, or can I revisit this, we can build a relationship in a far more effective way. So that's, we have not really left Rish on that yet, but that's the beginning of the parsha. Moshe is critiqued by God. The people exhibit a lack of ruach. Moshe seems to exhibit a lack of ruach at that point, and we're still trying to get off the ground. At which point Hashem says, okay, Moshe, you've now spoken to the people, go to the palace, speak to Pharaoh. And Moshe says, as he is wont to do, he says, I still don't want to go. Why does Moshe say at this point he doesn't want to go and speak to Pharaoh? What's his doubt about? He says, I am tongue-tied, exactly. Arel Sfatayim. Says, I am in a position where of an uncircumcised lips, however we might render that. I've got a stutter, I've got a speaking impediment, I struggle with expression. He says, I can't go. And this is something he indicated last week when he was sent on the mission, but eventually went. And now he says, Arel Sfatayim. Now, Shani, I still do not have a good sense of how to account for. And like last week where I left a question, I had a couple of you approach me over the course of Shabbat responding to a question I left with you, why Moshe buried the Egyptian in the sand. I'll leave you a question here as well, which is, Shani, we just get a genealogy. We've got this whole setup. And then we go, oh, and by the way, here's a story of the names of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi in Moshe's background, interrupting the flow. And there are a couple of comments. The Hertz Chumash has a comment. The Altschkoa has a note, but I haven't found anything truly that compels me yet as to why there's a sudden intervention of genealogy at this moment. That's not to say it doesn't exist. It's also just haven't had time to think about it, but I'll leave that with you. But the reason I mention it is because at the beginning of Shlishi, where we kind of get back to the storyline, Moshe ends Rishon by saying to God, I can't go to Pharaoh. I'm Arel Svatayim. He's not going to hear me. Shani has his genealogy, and then we get to Shlishi, which begins with God saying, go and speak to Pharaoh, and Moshe says, I can't, because what? Same reason. I need Arel Svatayim. How's Pharaoh going to hear me? Which is, if we are concerned with excess in one verse between, meaning this is a whole sentence repeated. You've got Moshe saying, I can't speak to Pharaoh because I'm heavy of tongue. We then got the genealogy, and then it says, and God says, go to Pharaoh. Moshe said, I can't, I'm heavy of tongue. It's a very odd moment where the genealogy seems to sit right between two moments that just repeat each other. And that is what the majority of the commentators suggest happened, is that the text literally repeats itself so as to say, we're back, you know, back to the storyline. This is where we were up to. As you might imagine, if you're in like a what are those comics or graphic novel where you've got kind of the storyline and then it gets interrupted with zigzags to like some side plot and then it comes back and you repeat the scene? Or if any of you watch series on television, at the beginning of an episode, they'll often have a recap of last week. Of course, on Netflix, they tend not to do that anymore because they know that we're all binge watching it straight away and we then waited a week in between. But in the old days, they used to say, and on last week's episode, and that's what people presume the opening of Shlishi is, where we say, oh, and as we said in Rishon, this is where we are. Everyone back to your places. And Moshe comes back to saying, oh, I can't go to Pharaoh because I'm heavy of tongue and heavy of lip. But of course, that doesn't sit well for some of the commentators, because there's a lot of times the text kind of veers off piste, and we don't always get, oh, and here's where we were. And what the Netziv observes here is that actually Moshe is making a second contention. His first contention was, Ani Aros Svatayim, I am heavy of tongue, I'm not going to be able to express myself. And this is about self-doubt. And then the genealogy appears, and one could suggest that the genealogy is there to give Moshe confidence. And then Moshe responds to that for the Netziv by saying, okay, I'll go. I no longer have doubts about my expression. But I'm still a poor speaker. I still have a stutter or a stammer or a lisp or whatever the commentators presume Moshe is confessing to. And I may well be comfortable dealing with that, but Pharaoh is not going to listen to me. Pharaoh is kind of one of these nobles who at the best of times sneers down the end of his nose at everybody around him. And if I kind of hobble in with my stick and my desert robe and I start stammering or stuttering or I speak with a weird inflection, Pharaoh's not going to pay any attention to me. And I'm comfortable standing there and projecting my message, God, but ni arel svatayim. How's Pharaoh going to listen to me? I'm not the person to make this case, not because I don't have the confidence, because this isn't how it works in diplomatic circles. And this is, for the Netziv, this is the most compelling argument that Moshe presents to God as to why he shouldn't serve in the role, which is why immediately following the next verse, God says, I'm going to have Aaron at your side as your Nevi'ech, as your prophet, as your interpreter. So this is a contention that he has, which is not about self-doubt, but about the reality on the ground that Pharaoh is going to not pay attention to someone he considers deficient. And God at this point says, I'll give you support. Don't worry. So that's Shlishi. And this is the first time God intimates that Pharaoh's heart is going to be hard, where Moshe is told, like you were disappointed last week when he didn't send the people free, it's going to happen again. I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will not let the people go straight away. Prepare for that, which raises a aspect of free will, which is why, how could God harden Pharaoh's heart and then hold him accountable for that decision? We don't have to go down that philosophical rabbit hole, but there are all sorts of ways to address why God seems to take away Pharaoh's free will. We'll go down it briefly. I guess Maimonides says Pharaoh essentially made a choice to give up his choice. If you make bad choices long enough, you can't make a contention against free will being ripped away. And that's how Maimonides seems to resolve it. The fact that we have free will, for Maimonides, is unnatural. For those of the scientific persuasion, the fact that we might have free will is a massive problem. When we think about the way the universe works, everything we know, if we operate through scientific assumptions, works through cause and effect. That's how the world works. And if you go to a pure reductionist of the scientific persuasion today, physicists, many will say, the idea that we have free choice is an illusion. We don't have free will. It's the only way we mentally could cope with the human condition is if we think we're in control, but it's an illusion. In the same way that if I drop something, it's going to fall to the ground. There are atoms that are going around in my mind, and I make choices on the basis of genetic causes, environmental causes, proclivities that I have that I've picked up over time, depending on who I engage. But everything is cause and effect. I don't make choices, really. Everything is scripted. Maimonides shares that outlook, not because of modern physics, because of medieval and Aristotelian physics. That cause and effect is the ultimate rule in the world as God made it. And the fact that we get to choose is an immense effort on God's part to interrupt the natural stream of things to give us responsibility. And at any time, God can withdraw that. And that's how Maimonides feels about Pharaoh in this instance. Others disagree and suggest that actually hardening Pharaoh's heart was God's way of preserving his free will, in that under ordinary circumstances, any leader, no matter how short-sighted or narcissistic, any leader whose economy is tanking, whose population is screaming, is going to, you know, that's a gun to the head. Any rational operating person feels like they have no choice and will just say, I'll do what you want. And what God does is he hardens Pharaoh's heart so that he's not influenced by the political reality or the economic reality. He's only making a moral choice about whether the Jews should be enslaved or not. And that's why God has to harden Pharaoh's heart so that the emotions of the experience don't overwhelm his moral sentiment. So at any time, he's constantly being asked to address only a single question: is slavery right or wrong? And the plagues for those commentators are not so much to coerce Pharaoh emotionally, but to illustrate theologically and morally that he's wrong. And so hardening Pharaoh's heart is actually a way to preserve his free moral will so that he can't make a good choice on the basis of emotional compulsion. So that's how some read his lack of free will. We then have I'll mention one thing. My daughter came home from school on who knows what day this week. She said, "Daddy, my Mora told me this week that Aaron's staff, his stick, snake, ate the snakes of the Egyptian magicians after it was already a stick again. And that's not what you told me. You told me that Aaron's staff was turned into a snake and the snake ate the snakes while they were all still snakes." And this is another example of something that I learned new. Because at that point, I assume the Mora is, you know, not making stuff up. And I actually didn't remember having that conversation with her over Shabbat because it didn't come up to this week. So she may have been remembering something from Pesach. And I said, yeah. And at that point, I was caught off guard because it was 8:15. She was meant to be asleep. It was 8:15 and I was nearly asleep. And at that point, how do I explain, textual ambiguity and exegetical assumption of the Midrash? The best of times, that's hard to kind of illustrate. And I don't remember how I resolved it because I think we were both unconscious about 30 seconds later. But it did remind me to look at the text. And the text is ambiguous where it says, this is the next moment in Revi where Aaron throws down the staff and it says, and it became a snake. And it says, Aaron's mater, his staff, ate the matot, ate the staffs. So read straightforwardly, it just means the snake was turned into a snake and Aaron's one ate the others. But the Gemara, which presumably the Mora was teaching to the class, says that this was a nes al hanes. This was a miracle within a miracle, that it was turned into snake and then it all turned back into sticks. And then Aaron's stick ate the sticks of the magicians. Now, of course, one could, this is not what we call the pshat. It is a exegetical rendering of why the verse calls it a mater. It says it turned into a snake and it should say tanin shal Aaron. It was his tanin that ate the other taninim. It says mater. Netziv again has an interesting reading. He says it goes to Mateh because usually when magic happens, and I'm sure we've seen magic shows, everything is an illusion or it's all kind of an illustration before the eyes. And then when the magic trick's over, everything goes back to the way it was. You know, you saw a woman in half. At the end of the trick, the hope is that was an illusion and we're all impressed, but actually she's in one piece at this point and that would be a huge problem if she wasn't. So the assumption is that the sticks would go down, they turned into snakes, Aaron's would eat the others and that would kind of be the demonstration. And then the miracle slash magic is over and everybody gets their stick back. And that kind of, it was a demonstration. And then Netziv says, no, this wasn't magic. This was God showing that this was a miracle, that it wasn't an illusion. The snake ate the others. So when they turned back into sticks, the Egyptian magicians were like, okay, good trick, but can we have our stick back? And Moshe was like, no, it actually, that wasn't magic. It ate the snakes. It is inside the stick. That was a manipulation of chemical reality. That wasn't an illusion. So that's how the Netziv reads it. So I thank my daughter and her Mora for leading me to look at that again. And I could leave that with you as well, which is, what would that demonstrate, that having sticks being eaten by a stick as opposed to in their state as snakes? Yes, it's more miraculous and more surprising, but then why get the snakes involved? Just have a stick eat the other sticks. It must be something about eating the sticks in their raw state that proves some point to Pharaoh. Then we head through, we have the first seven plagues. We're not going to run through them all. There's a lot to say about all of them. I'll make one closing remark as we wrap up, which is something I'd not seen before that I found intriguing, which is right at the end of this week's parasha, we have the final of the first seven, which is hail, barad. And Moshe does something he doesn't do in any of the other plagues, which is he offers advice to the Egyptians on how to avoid the worst of this plague. He says, hail is about to come. Take in all your farm animals, because this is about destroying the crops. I don't want all the animals to die. So take the cattle inside so they don't get destroyed. And it's a very odd moment, because in what was the plague right before Barad? Right before hail. I know it's like doing the ABCs backwards, not straightforward.
Shechin.
All right, good. Is it Shechin? Because I couldn't do them ahead backward either. What was the one before Shechin? I'm going to get my list out again.
Ever.
There we go. That was what I was looking for. Thank you. Shechin boils, I wanted to talk about at some point. It's true. Dever is where all the animals get sick. So he didn't seem that concerned about the cows back then. And now the hail is coming and says, oh, and take the cows inside. We don't want to hurt the cows. It's a very odd moment. And in theory, one could tie this to Tzar Balei Chaim and suggest that this was about not harming animals without purpose. Dever was that was structurally part of the message of the plague. It was a necessity. But this is about the agricultural economics, and I want you to get the cows out of the picture. But the Sforno makes an astonishing remark, which is something I imagine we tend not to think too much about, which is Egypt wasn't an aristocratic society that was purely nobles. It was also hierarchical in the sense that there were Egyptian indentured servants and Egyptian slaves, and the Jewish slaves were the worst, the bottom of the chain. But there were others who suffered under the regime of Pharaoh. And the Sforno says, why does Moshe tell them to take the cattle in? Because if you said to the Egyptian nobility, by the way, this storm is coming with hail that will rip flesh off to the bone. Take your slaves from the field inside. I don't want them to get hurt here. They're going to say, slaves, shmapes, leave them. But if you say to them, take the cows in, it's going to ruin your assets. It's going to ruin your farming capacity. They'll take the cows in. And the Sforno says, because of Tselem Elokim, that is why Moshe wants him to take the cows in. Because he understood, or it was understood, that out in the field of the Egyptian nobles were the cattle, and the enslaved shepherds, the Egyptian shepherds, who would be forced to do the work, the menial labor. And Moshe didn't want them to get harmed. So he says to the Egyptian nobles, take the cattle inside during this plague in order to spare the Avadim, the Egyptian slaves, because of their Tselem Elokim, which is just an astonishing observation on the part of the Sforno, that in the midst of trying to liberate themselves, there is a concern for those who are also victimized by this system of oppression who are not Jewish. And it raises a specter of what happens to those who are on the peripheries, who are not culpable or complicit in this system. And the Sforno just draws our attention to that. That this isn't a caricature of ancient myth where you've got the evil villain Egyptians and the innocent pure Jews. We've got a very complicated picture within it. Siv sees Jews as reluctant to leave, and we've got Egyptians who are enslaved themselves. And we've got a far more realistic image of how complicated liberty can be. And that will lead us into next week, where we'll have basically the end of the story, and we'll have to address at some point what some have called the boring part of Exodus, of Shemot, where we get to building the Mishkan, because all the drama is going to be finished in the next week or so, where we've got Bo and then Bashalach, and we're done, we're out. And we're going to have a little bit of drama with the golden calf. But this is making me queasy, because it reminds me that Pesach is coming soon. And we'll have to deal with that at some point. I know we've got Purim, we've got an extra month this year, but nobody tell me how many weeks it is till Pesach, because it's going to sound much quicker than it should be. But I will thank you again, Adele and Hai, for your sponsorship this evening. I wish your mother's neshama and Aliyah, Bat Jerivka, Bat Tzvi, and I wish you all just a restful, healthy Shabbat full of blessing and only goodness. I'm not running anywhere if you've got a question, observation, or comment, but I do want to wish you all just a wonderful Shabbat ahead.
Chag Kosher v'Sameach.